Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, David Lammy has called Israel's recent military expansion in Gaza intolerable. In Britain's biggest condemnation of the country since the conflict began, we'll be discussing whether this escalation in condemnation by former allies may affect what happens next in the conflict.
Also, the EU and the UK have finally struck a landmark trade deal aimed at resetting their post-Brexit relationship. And we'll be speaking to the former deputy leader of Reform UK about whether Starmer is attempting to rewrite the past with this deal.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
I recognise that people are still feeling the pressure of the cost of living crisis, including pensioners. And as the economy improves, we want to make sure people feel those improvements in their days as their lives go forward. And that is why we want to ensure that as we go forward, more pensioners are eligible for winter fuel payments. As you would expect, Mr. Speaker, we will only make decisions we can afford. That is why we will look at that as part of a fiscal event.
Cuts to winter fuel payments are set to be eased following mounting political pressure. Over 10 million pensioners lost out on the payments worth up to £300 when the pension top-up became means-tested last year. But speaking in the Commons yesterday, Keir Starmer said the threshold would change again to allow more pensioners to qualify. The original decision, announced shortly after Labour took office last year, led to fierce criticisms from unions and pensioner charities. More recently, the policy was blamed for the party's losses at the local elections last month. Ali, it's worth saying that we've got no detail on this. The Prime Minister's essentially said that they'd look at this at the next fiscal event, but it sounds like they're seeding the ground for a U-turn. Why now? You know, people have been shouting at this for ages. This was announced months and months ago. Why now?
Because these are the consequences of Keir Starmer's actions, I think. The local election result has clearly shaken Labour to its core. In fact, you know, we spoke about the reaction/overreaction on immigration that Keir Starmer gave. This is a continuation of that panic in Number 10 as a result of not just the local elections, but concerns about the 2026 elections as well. There's been a report this week in Labour List that Labour's finances are in tatters, that it's going to need £4 million to come in outside of its already budgeted income just to be able to fight the 2026 local elections, which for Labour are actually slightly more difficult than the most recent one because it's in more difficult areas. It's places that Labour have to defend. As a result of all of that, the MPs are starting to get jittery. And this is the number one lesson I'd give to anybody who might not fully understand or comprehend Westminster politics. As much as you'd like to think MPs are really principled people, the thing they're most principled about is their own jobs. And when their seats are at risk, that's when people start to kick off. And that's definitely what has happened. The PLP is up in arms. And so this U-turn, I think, is two things. One, to stabilise Labour's polling problem. The poll I don't know which ones you've seen. Because there's always loads out there. I saw one yesterday, I think 22%, which is tragically low.
And Reform are on 29%?
Yeah, they were about 7 points
maybe
ahead.
Something like that. They were leading the poll, somewhere between 27 and 29. The Lib Dems were coming in third, and the Tories were down to fourth place, 16%.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the interesting part is as bad as things are for Labour, they seem to be worse for the Tories. But that's caused a lot of anxiety within the PLP, and I think there's a reaction to that. So it's a stable... as much as they spoke about immigration in the initial reaction to the local election results, the actual data that I have seen suggests that winter fuel allowments, PIP cuts, that sort of stuff, had a far bigger impact on the vote than immigration did. Of course, immigration was also an important issue. But it's a reaction to that. Whether it'll calm down the PLP, I'm not sure. What's interesting is Labour MP Kat Eccles, who isn't on the left of the party at all, went on Times Radio and she said... and she urged the government to rethink its winter fuel cuts last year. And she said, it's annoying that we did raise these exact same concerns at the time. It's only now down the line, after we've had those local election results, that all of a sudden they're all ears to their MPs. It's like, what do you think the issues are? We told you months ago. Oof. So this is the you know, for an MP that's not on the left of the party, because Labour MPs tend to fall in line, particularly given this is a Prime Minister who won a massive major majority, Labour majority, for the first time since 2005. Mm. So speaking out against him this early is quite important. It's remarkable how quick the dominoes are falling for Keir Starmer.
I think the issue with this is, even if there is a U-turn, I think to some extent the damage has been done. Because essentially it was just handled really badly, whether it was leaked, whether it was deliberately briefed out. If you're coming into government and your message is we're all in this together and things are going to get worse, and then you immediately target a specific portion of the electorate who have a lot of political capital and who the papers in this country essentially cater to, you're going to be in for a rough ride. And the fact is, how this has been taken by pretty much every party is, and all voters, is this was an attack on the vulnerable, when there are other people who have, you know, made money and profited off the last 14 years essentially of Tory rule. And I think that is the issue. It was not just a poorly thought out policy, but it's a comms issue. What I will say is, it frustrates me to hear both the Tories and Reform making hay out of this, because it was in Kemi Badenoch's own leadership manifesto that she wanted to scrap the winter fuel allowance.
What was it?
There are several Tories who still believe not only should we scrap the winter fuel allowance, but we should scrap the triple lock. And they need to think about, do something about the state pension as well. There is actually a loud, you know, you wouldn't believe it now because they're all falling in line behind the opportunity to attack Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
There is a loud portion of the Tories who want more attacks on pensioners. And I will say this as well. Reform are making absolute hay out of this because obviously a large proportion of their voter base are pensioners. And they are Nigel Farage says he wants to reverse it. He backs reversing the winter fuel cut. I have heard a Reform councillor say yesterday that he believes not all pensioners should be in receipt of the winter fuel allowance. So what does that mean? Does that mean Reform are going to means test it? Mm-hmm. Well, we know, Ali, how problematic means testing is. Yeah. That's exactly what Labour tried to do. How would Reform's policies be any different? I suspect there is also a war brewing in the Reform Party about exactly what their policy on winter fuel would be, because I bet you they're keeping shtum now because they want their voter group to believe that they would just reinstate the winter fuel allowance. But I think in reality, where's that money going to come from?
You know, it's remarkable. Reform are getting away scot-free in the media.
No one's scrutinising their policies.
At all. They're not even expected. I don't know. Maybe it's because they're a new party. Maybe it's because they've never been in government. But they're being given a holy grail opportunity in politics, which is to just criticise, and you have no policy, no manifesto, no positions, no solutions to any problems. And what's remarkable is they're not even asked for one by the media. So, I mean, this remarkably reminds me of Donald Trump's first election campaign, where there is just this weird celebrity sort of feeling and momentum behind them, and the media gives them so much attention but no scrutiny.
It's total cakeism. You know, they want to roll back the state, but they want to reintroduce the winter fuel allowance. Anyway, we will keep pressuring on that, I'm sure. Okay, let's move on. This was an extraordinary scene in the White House again yesterday. President Trump confronted South African President Cyril Ramaphosa with a series of contested claims about the killings of white farmers in South Africa. In a meeting aimed at resetting relationships between the two countries, Trump asked his staff to play a video showing opposition South African politicians calling for violence against white farmers. Take a listen.
Excuse me, turn the lights down. Turn the lights down and just put this on. It's right behind you. These are burial sites right here. Burial sites. Over 1,000 of white farmers. And those cars are lined up to pay love on a Sunday morning. Each one of those white things you see is a cross, and there's approximately 1,000 of them. They're all white farmers, the family of white farmers. And those cars aren't driving, they're stopped there to pay respects to their family member who was killed. And it's a terrible sight. I've never seen anything like it.
They told you where that is, Mr. President?
I'd like to know where that is, because this I've never seen.
Ramaphosa responded by saying that he condemned the speech used in the video, and the leader of the opposition's speech and action were not government policy. Ali, this is obviously an extraordinary meeting. Ramaphosa managed to keep his cool, perhaps learning a little bit from Zelensky's previous experience. Do you think all global leaders need to essentially be on guard when heading to the Oval Office now?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure why any global leader now would agree to a public meeting with Donald Trump in that way. I mean, obviously, you'd have to go to the White House. I understand they're trying to reset relationships and it's part of the trade deal. Maybe it's on the insistence on the Americans that a portion of that meeting is public. But why would you put yourself through what Zelensky's been through?
Yeah.
What I'm going to try and pronounce it. Ramaphosa. Has been through. Can I just also say, BBC fact-checked this, the claims that were made about white genocide. South Africa had 26,232 murders last year, which is extraordinarily high. It's one of the highest, if not the highest, murder rates in the world. And it's reports from the South African Police Service. Of those 26,232 murders, 44 were killings of the farming community. 8 were farmers. And the figures are not broken down by race in any public stats or released. So there is absolutely no evidence, according to the BBC's fact check, of a white genocide. I thought it was strange, but then I started to think about it. It was a very strange thing for Trump to put his foot on the gas on, to go as far as showing the video. That's not been done before, to the best of my knowledge. And then I just started to think, why is he taking this issue so seriously? And why was it such a personal moment or such an issue for him to go beyond where he even went with Zelensky in terms of showing a video? I started to think, and I went, well, who else does he know that's South African?
Elon Musk.
And whose dad was...
But Elon Musk has been talking about white genocide on X for a long time.
Yes, but not just Elon Musk, but Elon Musk's dad, yeah. If you watch some of his interviews,
right.
White South African, who has been very vocal on these issues. And it's clear that that's where it's coming from.
Yeah.
So in my opinion, I mean, I can't prove it, but in my view, that's where it's coming from.
I think that's spot on. I think this is something to do with Musk, yeah. Right? But
because there's no way Trump knows where South Africa is, let alone that.
I think it's also worth pointing out that none of the political parties in South Africa have used this term white genocide. Even the party representing the Afrikaners.
Yeah.
Don't dispute this terminology. And, you know, for someone who came into office and said that he planned to put America first, where does he get off inviting international leaders into his office and admonishing them on the world stage? Is he an isolationist? Or is he the world police? Because I thought America was sick of being the world police.
Yeah, he's a weird sort of semi-isolationist. He does consistently talk about not being the policeman of the world. He actually did a speech in the Middle East on his most recent trip. That was remarkably sort of isolationist, but anti-traditional neoconservative American foreign policy, where he spoke about the fact that much of the growth in the Middle East has been outside of Western influence and other things. People should go have a look at that. But he is quite an isolationist. Mm.
I think he's an egotist. I think he does whatever he
thinks. I think
it's been
kind to attribute any actual doctrine or thought to him. Yeah.
Okay. Net migration fell by almost 50% in 2024, according to the ONS. New estimates showed 431,000 people more arrived in the UK than left over the past year, compared to 860,000 in 2023, which is the largest numerical drop on record. The decrease was driven by declining numbers of people coming to work and study in the UK, following changes introduced by the previous Conservative government. Tory leader Kemi Badenoch responded to figures, saying the numbers are still too high, while Reform UK leader Nigel Farage wrote on X, "Not as high as the great Tory betrayal, but still disastrous." So the finger pointing is already beginning.
Yeah.
I mean, really, this is down to measures imposed by Rishi Sunak's government, correct?
Yeah, but it's also a response to what Boris did.
Yeah.
So after Brexit, the Brexit vote took place, and we started to end free movement with Boris's government when the Brexit deal was signed. The Boris Johnson government actually laxed a lot of the visa rules, largely because he recognised the reality of how much the UK workforce is reliant on migrant labour.
Particularly the care sector, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so they relaxed a lot of the visa restrictions, which the UK has historically and globally been one of the toughest visa schemes anywhere in the world. Mm. The last Conservative government then sharply tighten those screws and those visa restrictions. So what we're seeing here, the ONS itself has said, is a plummeting number in people coming to work and study in the UK. This isn't stopping boats. This isn't stopping people claiming asylum in this country. It's a tightening of the immigration visa rules that stop people coming into this country to work and study, which ironically does a huge amount of harm.
Meanwhile, our care and health sector continues to crumble, as does our hospitality and agriculture. So that's all brilliant. Success across the board. Thank you, Kemi Badenoch. Okay, let's move
and
on.
Keir Starmer, who's also going down this road.
Yeah, I want to move on to this next story because it's a fun one. Reform have declared war on low traffic neighbourhoods, pledging to scrap them from the local council areas they control. However, none of the 10 areas they run have any in place. Reformers also pledged to sack council staff working on diversity issues or efforts connected to net zero, although it is unknown how many staff this would actually involve. Some councils, such as Lincolnshire, have said they have no diversity staff. What on earth does that mean? Presumably it means they have no staff working on D&I, okay, rather than they don't have any diversity within their staff. I mean, look, it's good to see Reform tackling all the big issues of the day. While special needs education cripples local authorities, while there is no social care provision, while many of them are going bankrupt, thank God they're declaring war on low traffic neighbourhoods and net zero. Voters must be delighted, Ali.
Yeah, I love that. I'm reading this. It says, Zia Yusuf, Reform UK's chair, said last week there would be a large-scale reversal of existing LTNs in the 10 areas across England where the party control councils. All 10 council areas controlled by the party told The Guardian they have no low traffic neighbourhoods.
So do they just not know what they're doing? Is this part of their, you know, push on net zero? This seems to be their new ideological war they want to fight, making everybody believe they have low traffic neighbourhoods.
No, I'm so, okay, how can I say this? I'm trying to say this politely, but I can't. They're a bunch of idiots. Yeah. They're morons. Reform UK are a clown car of absolute morons, led by the biggest clown of them all, people like Lee Anderson and Nigel Farage. And I don't want to be elitist, but there's something to be said about intellect in politics and actual intelligence. When we talk about this sort of stuff, experts and intelligence, for some reason our politics has moved to a space where that's a bad thing. I want to drive the movement for more intelligence in politics and less idiots like Lee Anderson. So if you'd like to join that movement, www.alimilan.com.
Okay.
There's nothing on that website. Don't bother.
But I think, you know, this is really important because local authorities have so many more issues than low traffic neighbourhoods. But it's also worth saying that in areas that have got low traffic neighbourhoods, for example, in London, yes, there have been some local issues with it. But low traffic neighbourhoods, clean air zones, all these things are actually starting to have provable successes for things like air quality, for things like traffic congestion. I mean, this is just an ideological war. Do you think people will see through Reform if these councils actually start to do worse, not better? And if they don't, does this just give Reform an opportunity to say, the only reason our councils or local authorities are failing in these areas is because of central government, still nothing to do with us, Gov?
Well, to be honest, people tend to vote nationally anyway. But I will say one of my experiences over a decade now campaigning with the Labour Party, a lot of times when I go into constituencies that I don't know and I end up campaigning, if the local authority, the local Labour government or the local Labour councils aren't great, it does a huge amount of damage. So I think in the previous segment where we were talking about Reform having nothing to hold them account next to, I think this might be the start of some really difficult days for them in actually being held to account for things that they did. I saw a tweet, may not be true, so strike me down if I've fallen foul to Twitter's misinformation. But I saw two of their councillors were like combined. They were like 22 and 23, and they were in charge of like £700 million or something stupid.
Yeah, they have huge budgets.
Yeah, and no, I'm all for younger people taking it. I don't think your age makes a difference, but if you're Reform and you're young, I think chances
are. There's some screw loose there. Okay. All right, well, that is the week unwrapped. Coming up, the Foreign Secretary has now suspended trade talks with Israel following a military escalation in Gaza. We'll be discussing whether Israel has gone too far and what happens next. We'll discuss all that next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
The lovely Matt Phipps.
Hello. The thing that surprised me most was how much joy I took in being like making people feel really uncomfortable. It's so
Amen.
Good. So good.
Your mum jokes change completely.
My friend the other day, she was like, "How tall is your mum?" And I was like, "Oh, she's 6 feet under." Yeah, they did not know what to do with that. Yeah. And then you let it hang in the air.
Yeah.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app. Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores. Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today. Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way from this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search "Don't Get Caught Out."
Pulse of the Nation with Andrew White on FUBAR Radio.
Danny Harmer, hello.
Thank you, what an introduction.
I heard in an interview, this may no longer be the case, but in 2020 you said you never actually read the original Tracy Beaker.
I've still never read it, and I'm gonna go down with this ship, and quite frankly, I shall never read it. I've got this far in life. And do you know what? I think it's kind of, in a weird way, I think it helped me get the part, because I had no idea of this character apart from the character that I made her.
That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
You might then see friends, family that require a little bit of support, financial advice. How do you go about sharing that advice, sharing that support without being condescending?
A practical tip that everyone can do that is low friction: send them financial content that you like. If you have a favorite content creator, if you see an article that you like, send them the video and just ask them, what do you think? And then that can begin a conversation around it.
At Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me.
The Honourable Lady seems incapable of offering any serious criticism about the egregious actions by the Netanyahu government, unlike many Honourable Members, on her own side. I think the whole House should be able to utterly condemn the Israeli government's denial of food to hungry children. It is wrong. It's appalling. Will she condemn it? Well, the whole House has seen. Opposing the expansion of a war that has killed thousands of children is not rewarding Hamas. Opposing the displacement of hundreds of thousands of civilians is not rewarding Hamas. On this side of the House, we are crystal clear. What is happening is morally wrong, unjustifiable, and it needs to stop.
Well, that was an extremely impassioned David Lammy in the House of Commons, talking about how Britain has suspended trade talks with Israel and summoned its ambassador to London over the country's intolerable military expansion in Gaza. Speaking in the Commons, the Foreign Secretary accused Netanyahu's government of isolating Israel from its friends and partners across the world and said Israel's blockade of Gaza was morally wrong. Lammy's comments represent Britain's strongest condemnation of Israel since the current war with Hamas started. Israel responded to the statement saying external pressures would not divert Israel from its path in defending its existence and security against enemies who seek its destruction. But can Israel really afford to continue the way it's going now that allies like Britain are turning their back on the country? I mean, it feels like Israel has just gone full fundamentalist with this, right? And, you know, it's nice, it's good to see that the David Lammy and the Labour government have finally found a bit of backbone here. But it's a bit too late, really, isn't it, to be frank?
It's way too late, yeah. I find myself in a really difficult headspace on this because in some regards, you'll know, I've been talking about this for many years now, way even before this round of fighting started, this genocide started. And to a certain extent, it's exhausting to have to keep saying the same things and trying to bring the government with you. But at the same time, it is like a move in the right direction to see the change in narrative and the rhetoric. So in some regards, when I hear David Lammy sort of banging that table and going, it's a moral outrage, disgrace that this is happening, you kind of take yourself to a position of, okay, but where were you when, you know, 14,000 dead children ago? Yeah. Oh, I don't know how many. I think it's been over 50,000 dead in Palestine, so I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head anyway. Where were you then, right? Why didn't we do this earlier? But look, we can't go back in time, so it's about what do we do now. The shift in rhetoric is certainly a step in the right direction, but there's a couple of outstanding stuff. I don't think the actions have actually matched the rhetoric at all. So Britain has cut a number, I think about 30 or so, of the arms licenses to Israel. The problem with that, though, is some really strong journalistic work has been done, and there are questions about whether that's actually been done and whether arms are continuing to flow from Britain to Israel.
Yeah, they wanted to make a distinction between
defensive and offensive weapons, which is nonsensical.
It's really difficult to
it's impossible to do, and actually has no basis in international law. You can't differentiate between the two. Anyway, a number of MPs, I think 70 odd MPs, have signed a letter asking for the foreign secretary to explain why there seems to be a continuous.
We're saying they're crossbenchers.
They're crossbench.
Well.
Yeah. So whether he misled the House on the comments in regards to suspending some arms exports, but also what's going on now, why British spy planes continue to fly from Cyprus over Israel. They have imposed some sanctions, particularly on settler organizations and some individuals, but again, it's nowhere near widespread. It doesn't block goods, commercial goods, settler goods coming into the UK, for example. And one of the key things as well is they still won't recognize a Palestinian state, still haven't done. There are rumors swirling around that I heard as recently as before we came on air that it may happen in the June 2nd meeting with the French, I believe. There's a meeting in New York, if I'm not wrong, of the international community. And that may be the starting point for recognizing a Palestinian state. But whether that comes to fruition or not, I don't know, because the narrative has always been it will be part of the negotiations, which is a ludicrous thing to say. I don't know of any other country in which their inalienable right just to be recognized as a people and as a state has been a condition of any form of negotiations or discussions or in the gift of any other state. Last thing I'll say before I'm sure you're going to want to jump in. I've not seen the reputation of Israel across the world in spaces you don't typically see as bad as it is now. Since the beginning of the war, I think what we've seen is Israel continuously breaching international law, the international human rights conventions, the very basic of human morality, and their narratives has always been it's Hamas. So they'll bomb a hospital and go, yeah, but it was Hamas underneath it. They'll bomb ambulances and go, Hamas were using that. If they kill children, they say you're using Hamas talking point. And I think what's happening now is the world is kind of shaking out of that and realizing what a nonsensical argument that is. And so I think the reputation of Israel around the world, and particularly for us here in Britain, is at the lowest it's ever been. And this might be a sea change moment, I think. I can certainly see this being a significant moment in which the British public's position, I mean, it's trended pro-Palestinian for a long time now, but this being a sort of page turner. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you said it all very well. I think it's reached a point where there are many people in, I think where the public sit on this in the UK is that They want to recognise a two-state solution. So they want Palestine to be recognised. They want Israel to be recognised. They understand that there is a, you know, a historical need for Jewish people to have a place of safety, but they also understand that it is not right to kick people out of a country and resettle people in the name of a specific religion. And, you know, in an ideal world, people would find a way to live side by side, but they understand that the history there is very complex. And they understand that the attack on October the 7th was horrific and that there are hostages that still need to be returned. But equally, how is collective punishment akin to genocide in any way a relative decision, you know, made by the Israeli government?
Can I just say, because people ask me this all the time when I do media rounds on this, of what did you expect Israel to do? Mm. What do you want Israel to do? International law is for precisely this moment. Mm. Proportionality is for precisely this moment. It's not for peacetime, right? We don't have international war crime rules on war for peacetime. We have them for wartime. And the reason that it's important that they're upheld is because one day we might be in a war, right? One day we may be on the end of war crimes being committed against us. And if we, as an international community, wash our hands of international humanitarian conventions, international law and human rights, then we will start to see that shredded everywhere. And what has been most extraordinary about this whole thing is the difference in rhetoric between Ukraine and Palestine for me. And so,
I don't know how much more evidence people need that Netanyahu is a war criminal, right? Mm. You have the bombing and killing of aid workers in the region. You have journalists unable to access the area. You have hospitals being bombed. You have people being forcibly removed from the areas in which they live. Otherwise, they are shelled and bombed to death. You have carpet bombing of certain regions.
Refugee camps.
You have the cutting refugee camps. You have the cutting off of water and baby formula and food. And the rhetoric coming out of his government that they want to raise Palestine to the ground.
The new one, they're going to. It looks like they're going to shut off water plants into Gaza.
I mean, it's
so. I mean, I think the comments that were made. I forget. I'm gonna look up who just as we're talking. Mm. But the comments coming out of senior members of the Netanyahu government tell you what their intentions are. There's no need for you to presume, for you to project, for you to assume anything. Mm. Right? They're telling you what they think.
What they want to do. I agree. And you know, to see pieces in the Telegraph saying that Labour's attack on Israel is completely unjustified, talking about, you know, the pernicious International Criminal Court case against Benjamin Netanyahu, suggesting that Britain would uphold the arrest warrant and take them into custody were they to set foot on our soil. I mean, the fact that we have suggested that we would uphold the decision taken by the International Criminal Court, yet somehow we should still support this man. I mean, how are those two things compatible? They're not. And, you know, you see these desperate attempts from people trying to justify Israel's actions here, but it is possible to support the Israeli people and the need for a safe place of sanctuary for Jewish people, but also be thoroughly disgusted and condemn what is happening in Gaza and what is happening in Palestine. And, you know, my grandfather was a Jewish refugee, and he found the ongoing situation in Gaza intolerable when he was alive. He supported constantly for the rights of Palestinians because he said, how can this be happening in the name of Judaism after we were forcibly removed and murdered from our own country and place of safety? It is not anti-Semitic to oppose the Israeli government's actions.
Some of the strongest voices against the Israeli government have been Jewish people bravely across the world. Sorry, I have just found who I was referring to, who I was thinking of. So the Israeli finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, has said, and I quote, "Within a few months, we will be able to declare that we have won. Gaza will be totally destroyed. In another 6 months, Hamas won't function as a functioning entity." He told a listening audience that the population of Gaza, some 2.3 million Palestinians, would be concentrated into a narrow strip of land between the Egyptian border and the so-called Morag Corridor, which runs between Gaza and Khan Yunis. And he said the rest of the strip will be empty.
But, you know, even if, right, even if that was in any way not a morally despicable, reprehensible idea, do you not think that extremism will grow in those areas of, if you forcibly remove people from their homes,
yeah,
the cumulative trauma and devastation and persecution, you are not going to get a compliant nation of Palestinians. Obviously, people are going to be deeply aggrieved by what's happened to them. And this isn't yeah, a formula for peace.
Can I tell you something? It's also, Metisan said this recently, and I completely agree with him. In one of Joe Biden's actual, like, with it moments, early in this whole saga, he said to Netanyahu, you need to learn from our lessons, the mistakes that we made. Us, the Americans, we learnt with the total failure that was the war on terror, that you can't blow up terrorism.
Yeah.
You don't destroy terrorism through force, right? Because what you do is, it's like pulling weeds out of your garden. You pull one out, 10 grow in its place. If you are a young Palestinian child in Gaza, right? Let's say 8 to 15, 16. You've watched your homes destroyed, your hospitals blown up, your schools blown up, your refugee camps carpet bombed, your mother and father have died, your sister and brother have died, your grandparents have died, your uncles have died, your friends have died, they've been carpet bombed. You've watched kids get sniped in the head. You've watched ambulances have 30 rounds emptied into them, right? The pull towards extremism is extremely strong. I'm not justifying it in any way, shape, or form.
No, but what do you expect
obviously
to happen?
I have to say this as a Muslim speaking on the air, because otherwise I'll get battered for it. I'm obviously against political violence in any way, shape, or form. But you would have to be an imbecile to not see the pull.
I completely agree with you. So okay.
Can we just say one thing as well while we're on air? Obviously, this morning we've had a Jewish couple in Washington D.C. who have been killed in what is clearly being looks like it's an anti-Semitic attack, and that should be called out as well.
Absolutely.
And so our absolute thoughts and prayers are with their family as well as Jewish communities who may feel less safe as a result.
Absolutely. Okay, coming up, Keir Starmer has struck a trade deal with the European Union after years of disagreements over Brexit. We'll be speaking to the former deputy leader of Reform UK about whether this is a betrayal of the referendum result. All that and more next.
Fubar Radio.
What the hell with George Bertineau on Fubar Radio.
I'm joined by Alex Mitten, retreat host and mentor.
I think a lot of people are lonely, surrounded by people at the minute. Like, you know, especially living in London, there's fucking people everywhere. But we sort of live these quite strange lives now where we're quite closed down emotionally, you know, even just like with our voice. We don't really speak that often sometimes, do you know what I mean?
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The Fubar Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
One in five people in the UK are disabled, and it's not always visible. So if we've made ourselves at home in priority spaces on the bus or train, surrounded by our shopping bags or bikes, we could be making it harder for the people who need that space more than us. So let's not forget about the people we share our journeys with, and keep priority spaces clear for others. Remember, it's everyone's journey.
When it comes to heart attacks, you might be surprised to hear the symptoms don't always feel severe. You could experience a squeezing across the chest, a feeling of unease, a sense something's not quite right. Don't be tempted to dismiss the signs and wait to see what happens. The faster you seek medical help, the better your chances. It's never too early to call 999 and describe your symptoms. Your NHS is here for you.
Couple Goals with Sophie Kasai and Jordan Brooke.
When is too early to say I love you? Soph said it the night we met.
Yeah. I did. Right, okay, right, let's just clear this up, right? When I said I love you, I remember I said it in the car.
In the cab, yeah.
In the cab, and I was like, oh my God, I love you.
Yeah, that was the thought I made to my girlfriend, wasn't it?
Yeah. And I said, I love you. And you were like, I love you too. And I was like, I love you, 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 I love you so much, I love you so much. Oh my God, I love you.
Death, a funny business on FUBAR Radio with Becky Briggs and Natasha Spencer-Levy.
We store so much of our trauma and our energy in our body. I am just incredibly, incredibly tired of keeping this trauma locked inside my body. And so all I needed to do is release it. You know, it's like going on a bender and drinking too much booze and you throw it up because you just need to get that out of your system because it's gonna catch up with you at some point if you don't.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUBAR Radio.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
And from that position of strength, today we have struck this landmark deal with the EU. A new partnership between an independent Britain and our allies in Europe. This is the first UK-EU summit. It marks a new era in our relationship. And this deal is a win-win. It delivers what the British public voted for last year. It gives us unprecedented access to the EU market, the best of any country outside of the EU or EFTA, all while sticking to the red lines in our manifesto about not rejoining the single market, the customs union, and no return to freedom of movement. So this deal is good for both sides.
The UK and the EU have struck a landmark deal aimed at resetting their post-Brexit relationship. The deal is set to allow British passport holders to use more e-gates in Europe and reduce the red tape currently needed to import and export food and drink between the UK and the EU. It also maintains the fishing deal struck in 2020 for a further 12 years and agreed a new defence and security partnership. The deal was criticised by Conservatives and Reform UK, who saw it as surrendering to the EU, while the Liberal Democrats praised the government for taking some positive first steps. So, has Keir Starmer surrendered the UK to the EU, or has he strengthened an important relationship? Well, joining us now to discuss this is Ben Habib, chairman of the Great British PAC and former deputy leader of Reform UK. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure you're going to have lots of thoughts about this deal. I want to know, just off the top of your head, are there any good things in this deal to start off with?
No, none.
None? What about...
It's an ideologically driven deal where the ideology that prevails is one that we must be aligned and alongside and ideally, if possible, in the European Union. That is the ideology underpinning this deal. It's not driven by a desire to put the United Kingdom first or to craft regulations or our military and defence aims with a British first imperative. It's driven by Keir Starmer's absolute predilection, as we know from the Brexit years, to get into the EU. And as he confirmed in September 2023 in Montreal, when he thought the cameras were off him, and he said, if I were ever to become prime minister, I would align us so closely with the European Union that actually people wouldn't be able to tell the difference. It's a complete ideological sellout for those of us who want to be out of the EU and out of the grip of supranational institutions, which I think have so damaged our democracy.
Ben, most Britons, 53%, say they would support Britain rejoining the EU, and 66% say they would support the UK having a closer relationship with the EU than it does now. And that actually includes 54% of those who backed Reform UK in 2024. You say this isn't what Britain wants, but it clearly is what the people want, isn't it? They want closer ties.
I didn't say it's not what Britain wants. I don't think we can't talk about polls put out like that. The Tories have been keen to portray this deal as the betrayal of Brexit, but actually leaving the EU has been betrayed repeatedly. It was never delivered. Theresa May tried to keep us in the entire EU single market, which would have subjugated the United Kingdom to foreign laws adjudicated by a foreign court. And then Boris Johnson said he would get Brexit done, but actually he left Northern Ireland behind. broke the Act of Union. Actually, technically, there's a Supreme Court ruling which states the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland as formed in 1800 actually no longer exists, but people don't seem to care. He hitched us to the regulatory hip of the EU through state aid, competition, employment and environmental law. He even committed to staying in the ECHR and so on and so on and so on. We've never had the opportunity in this country actually to make policies and to be governed independently of the wretched European Union. So when people say Brexit hasn't worked, people want to go back in. Actually, what hasn't worked, and I grant it immediately, are the two wretched treaties that Boris Johnson signed with the EU. But that they do not comprise leaving the EU. They do the opposite. They kept us within what Boris Johnson himself at once describes as the lunar orbit of the EU. Mm. And what Keir Starmer's done is take that, shorten that lunar orbit. He's brought us even closer into the EU. And just moving on from there, the United States of America, the most powerful country in the world, is ditching the European model of governance. It is ditching net zero. It is ditching DEI. It is putting up its borders. It is having an America first policy. And that in time, irrespective of what the markets might recently have done, that in time is going to produce a resurgent, proud, muscular United States of America. And if we continue to hitch our wagon to the sclerotic economic model that the EU practices, high taxes, big spending, great state, big state intervention, crazy policies like the drive towards net zero, we will be dramatically impoverished. What we've got to do is look across the Atlantic and take our lead from the Americans and become competitive like they're becoming.
Ben, Ali here. Good to see you, man. I have to pull you up on the Trump stuff. You know, I'm not going to let that go.
Pull me up.
You talk about a future, prosperous, growing, strong America. That may come to fruition. Neither of us can say for sure about what the future might hold. But it's been a little while since Donald Trump came into government, and his policies have only seen the economy in the US shrink. The markets have crashed. We've seen the Dow at record low rates, at least in the short term, in the most recent
history.
Well,
the S&P has recovered a lot of its lost ground. But
nowhere near where it was. And America is increasingly...
It's very close to the pre-tariff levels. But do not judge the crafting of a new economic model by a few weeks' worth of market gyrations. The entire Western economic and market system was hooked on cheap debt, lots of government interference. And what Trump is doing is throwing that out. He's saying, no, I'm going to champion private enterprise now. We're going to take away the protective blanket of the state. We're going to stop all this state spending. That's why DOGE has been put in place. That will have an immediate impact on the economy of a negative nature. But once you start repowering the private sector, what you're going to get is the kind of growth that we used to get in the 1980s, when actually aspiration existed, opportunity was exploited, there was an appetite to take risk. All these things have been dumbed out of the private sector over the last 25, 30 years as we've practiced this, you know, ever greater state intervention spending model. So there are going to be some pain. There's going to be some pain as the US repositions itself. But once it's done it, I have absolutely every confidence the American economy is going to outshine anything in Europe.
Can I ask you another question? Bring it back to the EU and the UK. Part of this deal has been a formal defense and security pact, which has been established. Given the threat of Russia and the increasing threat of war around the world, really, surely a closer defense and security agreement with our neighbors in Europe seeks only to benefit Britain, given that Britain's own leading military experts have said that we would only last about 6 months in a conventional war with the likes of Russia. So surely we need our allies' support, and that's a good part of the agreement.
Well, we have NATO with whom to cooperate in order to protect ourselves. That's an alliance that goes back, you know, to just after World War II. The European arrangement is a very different arrangement to NATO. And before I answer what it is, the United Kingdom is by far the although we're a shadow of our former selves, we're by far the most sophisticated, powerful military in Europe. It is Europe that will gain from our association, closer association with them. But Poland is catching up because they recognise the need for a strong military. But the real issue here isn't that we would cooperate with our, as he calls them, European friends and partners. We're doing that anyway through NATO on a military basis. What's happening with our military now is that we're going to be adopting effectively EU standards, a bit like, you know, the trading of goods and so on. We're going to be adopting EU standards when it comes to military hardware and software. We've already committed and are paying hundreds of millions of pounds a year into something called the European Defence Fund, which is the development of European weaponry with the aim of making European forces interoperable. And that's the key word. It's the interoperability of forces across Europe, which will actually, in the end, strip the United Kingdom of having an independently capable military that could be marshalled independently.
Why are they mutually exclusive? Why can't we have stronger ties in Europe and still be?
If you have a completely interoperable basis, we can't do anything without their blessing. And the other thing I should mention that's absolutely right. We're embedded we're enmeshed in their software, their hardware, their military. If they decide not to sell something to us, we won't be able to function because it'll be their systems that we use. But also, under permanent structured cooperation, the various projects of permanent structured cooperation, which we are now joining, we will not be allowed to challenge EU foreign policy. And so we will have to just nod along to EU foreign policy. This is, again, it's just symptomatic of this this obsession that Starmer has and some people have to be ideologically in all other respects, you know, in the EU.
But I hear your point about the US and it all sounds fantastic, but we are not the US. We have had very poor investment in our infrastructure over the last, couple of decades. We clearly have businesses who are struggling now and want frictionless trade. Why would it benefit us to pull ourselves further away from those trading blocks, from those trading allies, when we are a country so desperately in need of all the help we can get? This isn't me talking down Britain. There are things we can do, but clearly we are in dire straits and better deals with our allies will only strengthen our economy.
It's got nothing to do with talking up or talking down Britain. We need to look at this with a cold towel round our heads and do what's right. Now, the biggest signal that our relationship economically with the EU isn't working, at least for the United Kingdom, is that we've run perpetually a deficit of £100 billion a year, every year, for the last 15, 20 years. Every year. That is bleeding sterling. The only way that we avoid a collapse in sterling as a result of that is that we sell off our crown jewels, we sell off assets, so foreigners end up buying lots of the United Kingdom. Overall, our trading relationship with the EU has been a disaster for this country. People completely turn their back on the fact that we're bleeding £100 billion a year. And that impacts GDP because GDP, as you know, is a function of the trade surpluses and deficits that you carry across the globe. The EU has been dragging down our GDP. And in significant part, because Germany has the cost of its exports flattered by an artificially cheap euro and backdoor state funding that, you know, takes place across the board in particularly Germany, but, you know, across the board in the European Union.
Ben, last question, nothing to do with the EU, but your future, man, you're no longer in Reform. it seems like you and Nigel have broken up in what seems to be the big sort of celebrity breakup this year. What does the future for you look like?
Well, I do fear greatly for the direction of travel of Western civilization generally, which I think has been along the kind of path that we've just been discussing. And we do need to reset the way the United Kingdom is governed constitutionally, economically, and in all other respects. Reform isn't the answer. Reform is Farage. Farage is reform. He's a great showman. He's a great campaigner. But I'm afraid he doesn't actually, this is going to surprise you, Ali, he doesn't have what I would call a coherent political philosophical framework. He is the ultimate in political expediency.
I think you and me will agree there.
You will agree there. Okay, great. Well, then you know what I mean. So I am in the process of setting up something new, a new party, and people listening to this broadcast will probably think, oh my God, not another new party. But I think the two-party system is completely broken now. There is definitely a room for a party that champions good people, doesn't cut them down when they shine, that has a political philosophical framework to which it adheres, and is capable of producing coherent policies and draft legislation, and, as I say, have the people that are also capable of delivering it. And my aim in life is to assemble such a group of people.
Thank you so much, Ben. We will look out for that party. Very exciting. That was Ben Habib, chairman of the Great British PAC and former deputy leader of Reform UK.
Right, that's it from Politics Uncensored UK today. Politics Uncensored UK, I don't know where that UK came from. Oh, that's our Twitter handle. Before we go, I want to say a quick word to our wonderful producer, Maddie, who is leaving us this week.
And we're devoed.
And Maddie has been with us since the beginning of the show. She helped us set up, I think, 2 years ago now, and has brought the show leaps and bounds.
She's been fantastic.
You're going to be desperately missed, Maddie. I'm going to miss you so much every Thursday, but I'm sure we'll keep in touch. I've been doing this a long, long time in terms of media, as has Zoe, and I have not come across someone who is as committed and as easy to get along with and work with. So I'll miss you very much. You can join us. We're staying where we are next Thursday, although Zoe's going on holiday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK.
And me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com or via the FUBAR Radio app.
Download it from your app store now.
Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
Ciao.